You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support.
Welcome. This is The New Yorker. Today I'll be reading from the February 2nd issue, copyright 2026, Condé Nast. On the cover this week, a painting in soft, muted colors of a snowy winter scene in a city. We look down a long, straight street from a slightly elevated height. Buildings with rows of windows rise on either side, and an Art Deco-style skyscraper rises in the hazy distance. A neat row of bare trees lines the sidewalk on each side. Snow falls gently on the scene, and the cars parked on either side of the street are snow-covered. The only traffic visible consists of a few delivery people, each on a scooter or motorbike, riding through the snowy street. Each is bundled up in winter gear and carries a large orange food delivery pack on their back, each with a logo consisting of a fork, knife, and spoon in a circle. The illustration is titled New York's Toughest and is by Peter DeSev. The New Yorker Online provides this commentary on the image written by Francois Moulet. For the cover of the February 2nd, 2026 issue, the artist Peter DeSev celebrates the brave souls who continue to work when the city is paralyzed by a snowstorm. Blizzards have provided some of my very fondest memories of living in New York, DeSev said. All sound is muffled. The few cars on the road are reduced to a crawl, and big grown-ups like myself become kids again. Next is the talk of the town. Department of Twirls, still on ice. Nancy Kerrigan doesn't plan to attend the Winter Olympics in Italy next month, but she's excited to watch the U.S. figure skating contenders on TV. It's pretty expensive to go, she said recently, in a coffee shop in Bellport on Long Island. I probably wouldn't even be able to get a ticket. Nonetheless, her presence will be felt. The white, sheer-sleeved skating dress designed by Vera Wang that she wore when she won the bronze medal in 1992, 2 years before the leg bashing linked to her rival Tanya Harding, will be on display. Kerrigan, still plain-spoken and high-cheekboned at 56, had traveled from her home in Massachusetts to headline and host the Gateway Playhouse's annual Holiday Spectacular on Ice. Everybody's so welcoming here, she said, as her sneakers crunched on the snowy sidewalk. The other day, the local protesters for peace invited me to join them for coffee. Not to be political, but who could argue with peace? Kerrigan has her causes. She is transparent about fertility issues, having undergone 6 miscarriages, and she has raised funds for the vision impaired to honor her blind mother. She couldn't see much, but she knew when I fell, she said. She also served as an executive producer for a documentary on eating disorders in sports called Why Don't You Lose 5 Pounds? But her biggest cause seems to be keeping figure skating shows from melting away like glaciers. There just aren't the opportunities for young skaters like there used to be, she said. Not every skater gets to the Olympics. And most of the ones who did have left the ice. Sarah Hughes became a lawyer. Sasha Cohen went into finance. Michelle Kwan got into politics and became the ambassador to Belize under President Biden. Harding got into boxing, worked odd jobs, and then made some celebrity appearances after Margot Robbie portrayed her hand-scrabble life in the 2017 biopic, I, Tanya. Kerrigan no longer has contracts with Campbell's, Seiko, Old Navy, or Revlon. She lost other deals decades ago. It may not have helped that she was caught on a hot mic calling her role in a Disney World parade dumb. But she still skates and shows. She and her husband manager, Jerry Solomon, have paid the bills with choreography, book deals, creating Halloween on Ice, and making television appearances, for example, on Fox Sports' Dancing with the Stars and a Kardashian Christmas special. She refutes with a gutsy laugh, an internet report putting her net worth at $10 million. "I raise three kids, and that's expensive," she said. Inside the historic theater's lobby, she greeted the staff warmly, then signed copies of Stronger Than She Thinks, a children's picture book she co-wrote about a persistent little skater named Nancy. The 500-seat house had sold out. "I just hope the audience is energetic," she said. "Last night, a gentleman in the front row was asleep. I guess he felt relaxed." On the way to her shared dressing room, she looked at the stage set, a wintry city park with a skating pond of ice, which was kept frozen by chilled glycol circulating underneath. Two stagehands were smoothing the surface with bladed scrapers. Kerrigan's father, a welder, drove a Zamboni to pay for her pre-dawn practice time as a kid. He died in 2010 following an altercation with one of her brothers. "The stage was minuscule compared with most rinks. I'm used to it," she said, "although the ice is a little hilly." During the show, Kerrigan shared the crowded stage with 14 skaters and singers, dressed as a cowgirl and a bathrobed mother, and then in a progression of little skating dresses, she had the audience in raptures. She pulled off an axel, a mazurka, and other moves with grace, although she warns people not to expect to see her do the old Olympic tricks. Afterwards, in the wings, she hugged the youngest skaters, kissed a pug, and fist-pumped the cast like a big sister. In the lobby, she greeted a crowd of happy fans. Many older admirers told her that she hadn't changed. She smiled a snow-white smile for a long series of selfies, telling one wiggly little boy at her side to hold still and stand up straight. Walking back in the silvery moonlight to a nearby Victorian house where she was staying, she recalled falling during a Gateway show in 2023 and breaking her arm. "My name was on all the signs and posters, so I went on and I did my best," she said. A herniated disc flares up sometimes too, but she keeps doing her shows. "As athletes, we're expected to be in pain and work through it," she said. "That's what we do." And that article was written by Bob Morris. Our next article is from American Chronicles, titled Fake News: How Tucker Carlson Became the Most Trusted Voice in Right-Wing Media. And this was written by Jason Zingerly. In October, a few days before Halloween, Tucker Carlson invited Nick Fuentes to his home in rural Maine. For months, the two right-wing media stars had been savaging each other on their respective platforms. On the Tucker Carlson Show, one of the top-ranked conservative political podcasts in the country, Carlson had called Fuentes a weird little gay kid in his basement and suggested that he was being used as a pawn by sinister, possibly government-controlled forces. "I have noticed that his targets are all people who are sincere, non-crazy, non-hateful opponents of neocon politics," Carlson said. "He is clearly part of a campaign to discredit non-crazy right voices." Fuentes, on his late-night streaming show, America First, which averages about 500,000 viewers on Rumble, had alleged that it was Carlson, in fact, who was the deep state agent, unspooling a Baroque conspiracy theory in which Carlson has worked as a CIA asset since college. "Everybody's calling everybody else a Fed, but I think this one's pretty cut and dry," Fuentes said. "Who's the CIA cutout? Who's the poseur? Who is America? I am America." Addressing Carlson, he added, "You disgust me, but seriously, you are filth." The reasons for the mutual animus weren't entirely clear. At 27, Fuentes was arguably America's most prominent white nationalist, someone who was forthright about and seemingly proud of his bigotry. Summing up his core political beliefs last year, he said, "Jews are running society. Women need to shut the F up. Blacks need to be imprisoned for the most part. And we would live in paradise. It's that simple." On another occasion, he said, We have to go a little bit further than to say something's up with the Zionists or Israel. It's not Israel, it is the Jews. These and other similarly odious utterances, questioning the Holocaust, celebrating Hitler, frequently using the N-word, meant that Fuentes was no stranger to criticism from fellow right-wingers. During the 2024 election, the Republican vice presidential nominee, J.D. Vance, was asked about Fuentes, who had recently attacked Vance for having an Indian-American wife and therefore being an insufficient defender of white identity. "Look, I think the guy's a total loser," Vance said. "Certainly I disavow him." But Carlson was a conservative who didn't feel the need to put much distance between himself and Fuentes. In 2019, when Carlson still had a primetime show on Fox News, he interviewed an extreme anti-immigration North Carolina congressional candidate named Pete Diabrowska. After the show, the conservative writer Jonah Goldberg, who disagreed with Carlson's anti-immigration stance but still considered him a friend, sent Carlson a text message alerting him to the fact that Diabrowska was being strongly supported by Fuentes. In response, Carlson sent Goldberg a series of hostile texts professing ignorance and warning Goldberg not to make his criticism public. After Carlson was fired from Fox News in 2023, he often gave voice to incendiary views that were not substantively different from Fuentes' own, especially as they pertained to Israel and certain prominent Jewish figures. Carlson employed classic anti-Semitic tropes in attacking Ukraine's Jewish president, Volodymyr Zelensky, describing him as rat-like and a persecutor of Christians. In the middle of the war in Gaza, Carlson accused Israel of blowing up churches and killing Christians, and criticized the conservative commentator Ben Shapiro, an Orthodox Jew, and other pro-Israel Americans for being focused on a conflict in a foreign country as their own country becomes dangerously unstable. "I'm from here," Carlson said. "My family's been here hundreds of years. I plan to stay here. I'm shocked by how little they care about the country." On his podcast, Carlson has twice interviewed Daryl Cooper, a Nazi apologist who has argued that concentration camps were a humane solution to widespread hunger during the Second World War, and whom Carlson introduced to his audience as the best, most important popular historian working in the United States today. After Charlie Kirk's death in September, far-right influencers promoted a conspiracy theory that, because Kirk's long-standing support for Israel was waning, the country had orchestrated Kirk's assassination. Carlson gave a eulogy at Kirk's memorial service in which he likened Kirk to Jesus, and then implied that Jews had killed Jesus. "I can just sort of picture the scene in a lamp-lit room with a bunch of guys sitting around eating hummus thinking about, what do we do about this guy telling the truth about us?" Carlson said. "We must make him stop talking." Perhaps the feud between Carlson and Fuentes could be attributed to the narcissism of small differences. In any case, Carlson was losing. On social media, he was getting pilloried by Fuentes' legions of fans, many of them alienated young conservatives who call themselves Groypers, in honor of an obese version of the Pepe the Frog meme. "Tucker's mask slipped," Fuentes gloated on his show, and he forgot for a minute that for 8 years he's been pretending to care about the plight of weird kids in their parents' basement who are broke. Carlson has long possessed a finely tuned professional and political radar. In the early 2000s, when he was a gifted young magazine writer, frequently contributing stories to publications like New York and Esquire, he realized that print journalism would no longer offer the same fame and power that it had once afforded his literary heroes, such as Hunter S. Thompson and Tom Wolfe. He abandoned print to work as a pundit on CNN. During the 2016 campaign, he revived his flagging cable news career by being an early defender of Donald Trump's presidential bid, recognizing that a populist candidate who campaigned on nativism, white grievance, and sexism might have a lane in the Republican primary. He was ultimately rewarded with his own primetime show on Fox News. And in the 2.5 years since he'd been fired from Fox, he'd masterfully navigated the attention economy, starting his own media company and routinely drawing enough outrage and eyeballs that he reestablished himself as the most significant media figure on the American right. Now he had concluded that if he had wanted to maintain that perch, he could not afford to alienate the Groypers, and so he extended an olive branch to Fuentes in the form of a podcast interview request. Fuentes was wary. Carlson can be a tough interviewer. In June, he hosted Senator Ted Cruz on his podcast and ridiculed him for not knowing the population of Iran, despite favoring regime change in that country, and for not being able to provide a specific citation for a Bible verse that Cruz invoked to justify his support of Israel. Fuentes feared a similar ambush. But the night before their interview, during dinner at Carlson's house in Maine, Carlson went over the topics that he wanted to discuss with Fuentes. The next day, their two-hour-plus conversation could not have been chummier. The pair reveled in their mutual contempt for Cruz, Shapiro, and the Fox News host, Mark Levin, celebrated their shared identity as American nationalists, and commiserated about being deemed racist and anti-Semitic. Carlson apologized to Fuentes for calling him gay, and they both acknowledged that neither of them was a Fed. Their biggest point of disagreement was whether all Jews were to blame for the U.S.'s misguided support for Israel, as Fuentes believed, or just some of them, as Carlson maintained. It's not cucking to say that you're not talking about all Jews when you oppose a foreign policy position, Carlson said, noting that many self-described Christians have been seized by this brain virus of Zionism. Eventually, they appeared to reach a sort of consensus that organized Jewry, as Fuentes called it, was the problem. Carlson's sit-down with Fuentes fractured the conservative movement. In the days and weeks after the interview aired, prominent Republican politicians and conservative commentators lined up to denounce Carlson for giving Fuentes a platform. Shapiro called it an act of moral imbecility. Cruz, in a speech to the Republican Jewish Coalition, said, "If you sit there with someone who says Adolf Hitler was very, very cool and that their mission is to combat and defeat global Jewry, and you say nothing, then you are a coward and you are complicit in that evil." When Kevin Roberts, the president of the Heritage Foundation, which had advertised on Carlson's podcast, released a video message attacking Carlson's critics as a venomous coalition and the globalist caste, Heritage staffers rose up in protest. 5 board members resigned. Carlson, who did not participate in the reporting for this piece, said in an interview with Megyn Kelly that his critics can buzz off. Carlson was not the first prominent conservative to have a close encounter with Fuentes. In 2022, 2 Republican House members, Paul Gosar of Arizona and Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, delivered speeches at Fuentes' America First Political Action Conference in Florida. More significantly, that same year, Trump dined with Fuentes after Ye, the artist formerly known as Kanye West, brought him as his guest to Mar-a-Lago. At the time, the outcry came mostly from liberals. Perhaps the conservatives who stayed silent when Trump met with Fuentes but lambasted Carlson for doing the same were simply picking an easier, more convenient target for their virtue signaling. But it's also possible that the people who were more alarmed by Carlson's dalliance with Fuentes concluded that Carlson was a bigger threat to the conservative movement than even Trump himself. Carlson's evolution from cable news journeyman to conservative movement leader began in the winter of 2009 when he received an unexpected phone call from the head of Fox News, Roger Ailes. Carlson, who had recently been fired from his job as a primetime anchor on MSNBC, would later confess that at the time he was at a professional and personal nadir. 4 years earlier, when he was hired at MSNBC, he had moved his wife and their four kids from Washington, D.C. to the ritzy town of Madison, New Jersey, where he paid $3.3 million for a 9,000-square-foot mansion and drove a Hummer. So when MSNBC canned him, he didn't just lose his job, he lost his lifestyle and his identity. I looked around and I was like, oh, wow, I'm living this totally unsustainable life and I'm not making any money, Carlson later recalled. It was a pretty low-grade disaster. I didn't lose a limb in war or get paralyzed in a car accident. But for me, who'd grown up in a pretty privileged world, it was distressing and a shock. Carlson sold the New Jersey mansion and returned with his family to Washington. Pulling into his driveway at night, he thought that he saw his neighbors averting their gaze. He couldn't shake the feeling, he said, that everybody hated me. But the reality was actually worse. People didn't hate Carlson. They didn't think about him at all. Ailes never much cared for Carlson's preppy fraternity rush chair shtick. His taste in cable news hosts, male ones, that is, ran toward confrontational populists like Bill O'Reilly, who was then Fox's biggest star. Ailes also wasn't one to forget a slight. I don't ignore anything, he once said. Somebody gets in my face, I get in their face. He no doubt remembered all the nasty things that Carlson had said over the years when he worked at CNN and MSNBC about Fox, a mean, sick group of people, O'Reilly, a humorless phony, and Ailes himself, sucking up to power. According to an account of the phone call with Ailes, which Carlson later related to his former college roommate, Neil Patel, Ailes began their conversation with a gratuitous insult. "You're a loser, and you screwed up your whole life," he said. It seemed as if Ailes just wanted to get in Carlson's face. But then, before Carlson could hang up, Ailes got to the point. "The only thing you have going for you is that I like hiring talented people who have screwed things up," he told Carlson, "because once I do, you're going to work your ass off for me." Ailes especially relished hiring broadcasters who had flamed out at other networks. O'Reilly, who'd anchored the syndicated tabloid show Inside Edition, had left television entirely and was studying for a master's degree in public administration at Harvard when Ailes brought him to Fox. "I look for people who haven't reached their potential," he said. "I think I'm pretty good at developing talent." By resurrecting careers, Ailes was able to prove his own genius, that the audience he convened was so large and so loyal that Fox was capable of making almost anyone a star. "I could have put a dead raccoon on the air this year and got a better rating than last year," he once boasted. Ailes grew up in the blue-collar town of Warren, Ohio, where his father worked in a Packard electric factory. Memories from his youth of seeing college boys give my dad orders in the shop in an inappropriate manner, he later said, were seared into his brain. No matter how much wealth and power Ailes accrued, he never lost the sense that he was an outsider in New York's media elite. "They think I'm this rube from Ohio," he complained of his peers in the city's executive class. "They all look down their noses at me." Counterintuitively, hiring Carlson, the son of a former U.S. ambassador, whose stepmother was an heir to the Swanson frozen food fortune, presented an opportunity to exact some revenge. Roger liked the idea of Tucker coming to him on his hands and knees, one former Fox executive said. Roger took no small amount of pleasure in being able to tell Tucker Swanson, McNear Carlson, "You're a loser." Ailes offered Carlson a contributor contract at Fox. It was the same type of deal that Carlson had received from CNN a decade earlier, when he was still a magazine writer and was just breaking into the cable news business. 5 figures a year to appear on the network's various programs when they needed to fill airtime with a talking head. It was quite a comedown, in both compensation and prestige, from having his own primetime show. But for Carlson, it was a lifeline. He was grateful for the money, even if it was a pittance compared with the salary that he'd earned as an anchor. and he was glad to still have a place, even a tenuous one, in television. "I'm doing whatever they want me to do," he told the Times when his Fox deal was announced. Carlson knew that he was low in the pecking order at Fox. Still, he had ambitions. His biggest was to become a regular on the so-called all-star panel on Special Report, Fox's 6 p.m. political news show, which was broadcast out of the network's Washington studio and was considered Fox's most highbrow cerebral program. But Ailes had other plans. Roger loved kicking Tucker down the stairs and beating him up, the former Fox executive said. That meant not just denying Carlson the opportunities he craved, but saddling him with obligations he hoped to avoid, like co-anchoring the weekend version of Fox and Friends, which was less political and even more aggressively stupid than its weekday counterpart. Roger's idea was to throw Tucker onto the worst thing, the weekend morning show, the former Fox executive said. It's early. He has to go to New York. He has to drive go-karts. It was inconvenient and humiliating. Outwardly, Carson appeared to embrace the assignment, eventually becoming a full-time weekend anchor. He not only careened around the set in a go-kart, he participated in cooking segments with guests like Billy Ray Cyrus, played the cowbell with the 70s rock band Blue Oyster Cult, competed against and lost to his female co-anchor in a Spartan race, and subjected himself to a dunk tank. Just as Ailes had predicted, he worked his ass off, and he did it with a smile. He never acted too good for it, the former Fox executive said. A lesser person would have said, "I had two primetime shows." And yet, although Carlson might not have said it, he certainly thought it. He struggled with the Fox and Friends pre-dawn call time, at one point dozing off while on air, and he hated being away from his family and his social circle in D.C. He tended to spend his weekends in New York alone, hunkered down in his hotel room, tying flies, and then walking a dozen blocks to Central Park to fish in one of its ponds. One afternoon while fly casting in Central Park, Carlson noticed a man with a video camera standing in some nearby bushes. Seeming to assume that he was a paparazzo or a liberal stalker, Carlson confronted him. "Are you videotaping me?" he demanded. The man confessed that he was because he'd never seen anyone fishing in Central Park before. He explained that he recorded things that he found interesting and unique about the city of New York, and then uploaded them to his YouTube channel. As the man peppered Carlson with questions, "Where did you grow up? Do you live in New York now?" it became clear that he wasn't a paparazzo or a stalker. Indeed, the man had no idea who Carlson was. Charmed, Carlson proceeded to rhapsodize about fly fishing. They continued to talk, and the man told Carlson about his other pastime, pranking journalists. Now Carlson no longer seemed so happy about his anonymity. "What's your favorite cable channel?" he asked. "CNN," the man told him. "Do you watch Fox?" Carlson pressed, perhaps hoping to kindle a spark of recognition. "I watch Fox," the man replied. But no, still not so much as a glimmer. Even to a self-professed cable news junkie, Carlson was now just some random weirdo fishing in Central Park. For most of his time at Fox News, Carlson was far removed from the decisions that were made and the dramas that played out on the second floor of the news channel's Manhattan headquarters, where Ailes and his top lieutenants had their offices. On his trips to New York, he'd sometimes stop by to schmooze with Fox executives and remind them of his existence. He seemed a little lost, someone who encountered Carlson on one such visit remembered, and he was always seeking opportunities to demonstrate that he was aligned with the network's biggest and most important projects. As Carlson half-jokingly told a shock jock radio host about Rupert Murdoch, I'm 100% his B-word. Whatever Mr. Murdoch says, I do. But these displays of loyalty didn't seem to boost his standing inside the organization. Relegated to the frivolous afterthought of Fox and Friends weekend, Carlson was on the outside looking in. Until, that is, Trump's first presidential campaign. Carlson was by no means a fan of Trump's. In 1999, when Carlson was still a magazine writer, he branded Trump the single most repulsive person on the planet. A few years later, after Carlson had become a cable news host, he made a throwaway joke about Trump's hair on CNN, and Trump responded with a short voicemail. "It's true, you have better hair than I do," he said in the message, "but I get more P-word than you do." Carlson thought that the episode was funny. It maybe even made him like Trump a little bit. It didn't, however, make Carlson think that Trump was suited to be president. By the 2016, Carlson's thinking had begun to evolve. Part of the change was a result of his usual contrarianism. On my street in Northwest Washington, D.C., there's never been anyone as unpopular as Trump, he wrote in Politico during the campaign. Idi Amin would get a warmer reception in our dog park. Carlson believed it was his long-established role in the city's political and media ecosystem to defy that consensus. But there was a deeper, more substantive reason for the shift in his attitude. 6 years earlier, Carlson and Patel, who'd served as a chief policy advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, had launched the Daily Caller, a news website that they vowed would be the conservative answer to the Huffington Post. Instead, in pursuit of clicks, the site found itself competing with Breitbart News to produce increasingly inflammatory takes on immigration, race, and gender. Carlson had immersed himself in the site's web traffic metrics, which served as an early warning system of where the conservative base was headed. This insight made Carlson unusual at Fox. In 2014, Ivanka Trump had arranged a lunch with her father and Murdoch, according to the journalist Joshua Green's book, Devil's Bargain. "My father has something big to tell you," she announced at the lunch. "What's that?" Murdoch asked. "He's going to run for president," she replied. Murdoch did not even bother to look up from his soup. "He's not running for president," he said. Murdoch and Trump had been friendly for decades, and they traveled in some of the same New York social circles, but Murdoch did not take Trump seriously, not as a person, not as a businessman, and certainly not as a presidential candidate. Neither did the pundits at Murdoch's cable news channel. Even among conservatives at Fox, there was the view that Trump's an idiot, he's not a serious person, that there wasn't a chance of him winning. Ken LaCourte, a former Fox News executive, recalled. This posed a problem for Fox, especially since Ailes knew that covering Trump was good for ratings. To make for compelling television, the channel needed to put people on air who wouldn't simply dismiss Trump out of hand. The project at Fox of trying to find normal-seeming television camera-ready human beings who would make a sensible case for Donald Trump was no small lift, a former Fox producer said. Enter Carlson. Fox producers had taken notice of the heterodox views about Trump that he was offering on Fox and Friends weekend. Soon he was appearing with increasing regularity on Special Report, whose all-star panel had become something of a never-Trump readout. A few days after Trump officially announced his candidacy, Charles Krauthammer, the panel's most esteemed member, hailed Jeb Bush's official campaign announcement as the biggest news of the race. Carlson countered that Trump's entry would significantly complicate Bush's bid for the Republican nomination. "Trump was filling the role of the candidate who has his opinions," Carlson said. "Some of them are kind of interesting. Some of them are right, by the way. He can say exactly what he wants. I think it could potentially be a problem." Going into 2016, Murdoch and Ailes believed that Fox had the power to pick the GOP's nominee. But as the campaign went on and Trump's hold on the Republican primary electorate became clear, Murdoch and Ailes recognized that Trump had the power to topple Fox. Before long, O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, and even Megyn Kelly, who had famously clashed with Trump during the first GOP debate, were boosting him on their shows. In September, 2 months before the general election, Hannity filmed a testimonial for Trump that was featured in a campaign video. Carlson never went that far, but Murdoch didn't forget his prescience. In the summer of 2016, after more than 20 women at Fox News alleged that Ailes had sexually harassed them, Murdoch forced Ailes to resign and took control of the news channel, appointing himself as its interim CEO. Murdoch sought to stabilize Fox, but also to plot a course for its future, a future that, no matter what happened on Election Day, would have to take into account a viewing audience that had been deeply affected by and was now extremely loyal to Donald Trump. In November, 5 days before the election, Murdoch made his first big move. Fox News announced that its new 7 p.m. show was Tucker Carlson Tonight. In the aftermath of the 2016 election, a small group of conservative intellectuals tried to reconcile their ideological movement with the man who now improbably sat atop it. They identified themselves as National Conservatives, or NatCons. At think tanks like the Claremont Institute and in journals and on websites such as American Greatness and The Federalist, the NatCons tacked hard to the right on culture war issues, denouncing critical race theory and drag queen story hours while voicing a set of economic concerns more typically associated with the left, supporting child subsidies and industrial policy. Depending on your point of view, NatCons were either attempting to add intellectual heft to Trumpism or trying to reverse engineer an intellectual doctrine to match Trump's lizard brain populism. Either way, it was a difficult, frequently humiliating task. Trump proved to be a vexing ideological lodestar, aggressively anti-intellectual in his attitudes and consistently inconsistent in his views. Which is where Carlson came in. Each night on Fox, he articulated a populist nationalist ideology that was far more coherent than anything being offered by Trump himself. Carlson's worldview, which was eventually described in much of the press as Trumpism without Trump, mixed anti-immigrant and oftentimes outright racist tropes with a clinical dissection of consumer capitalism and its deleterious effects on American families, the working class, and civic society in general. It was a highbrow version of white grievance, which painted the country as imperiled by a callous ruling elite and the violent migrant hordes infiltrating its borders. Carlson, with his staple rep ties and Rolex, assumed the role of class traitor. The entire package was irresistible to NatCons, who began to view him as much as Trump as their standard bearer. Carlson's show specialized in finding relatively unknown liberals for him to slap down. It also excelled at taking stories, arguments, and conspiracy theories from the far-right corners of the Internet and putting them in prime time. On one episode, Carlson would run a segment about Romanian immigrants, he referred to them less kindly, who had settled in a Pennsylvania town and who defecate in public, chop the heads off chickens, leave trash everywhere, and more. On another night, he'd complain in his monologue that America's leaders insist that we've got a moral obligation to admit the world's poor, even if it makes our own country poorer and dirtier and more divided. Just days after a racist white gunman killed 23 people in an attack on Hispanic shoppers at a Walmart in Texas, Carlson insisted that white supremacy was actually not a real problem in America, and that it was, in fact, a hoax. In the summer of 2018, Carlson devoted multiple segments to South African land reform policy, falsely claiming that the country's black-led government was seizing the farms of white South Africans because, according to him, they are the wrong skin color. He went on, "That is literally the definition of racism. Racism is what our elites say they dislike most." 7 years later, the plight of white South Africans became the core of the second Trump administration's refugee resettlement policy. In 2019, Carlson devoted an 11-minute monologue to the woes of Sidney, Nebraska, which had once thrived as the headquarters of the sporting goods chain Cabela's. After Cabela's merged with Bass Pro Shops, the headquarters was closed, costing a town of 6,000 people more than 2,000 jobs. The merger, Carlson explained, was done at the behest of a hedge fund run by the billionaire Republican megadonor and Jewish philanthropist Paul Singer, which had taken an ownership stake in Cabela's and netted nearly $19 million after the merger drove up the retailer's short-term share prices. This sort of vulture capitalism, Carlson told his viewers, bears no resemblance whatsoever to the capitalism we were promised in school. It creates nothing. It destroys entire cities. It couldn't be uglier or more destructive. So why is it still allowed in the United States? The short answer, because people like Paul Singer have tremendous influence over our political process. Mike Enoch, a prominent white supremacist, shouted out Carlson's remarks about Singer on his podcast, The Daily Shoah, noting that Carlson had begun the segment by describing how the notoriously anti-Semitic Henry Ford once raised the wages of his workers. If you didn't catch the German Shepherd whistles where he praised Henry Ford and then went into a diatribe of a Jewish financier, Enoch said approvingly, I don't know what universe you're existing in. Blake Neff, the head writer at Tucker Carlson Tonight, was responsible for many of the words that came out of Carlson's mouth. As he once boasted to Dartmouth's Alumni Magazine, anything he's reading off the teleprompter, the first draft, was written by me. The anti-immigrant and racist sentiments that dominated the show came naturally to Neff. At the same time that Neff was writing for Carlson, first as a reporter at the Daily Caller and then as a staffer on Tucker Carlson Tonight, he was also writing posts on a racist and sexist message board called Auto Admit. Posting under the username Charles XII, the 18th century Swedish warrior king who later became an icon for Swedish neo-Nazis, Jeff joked about foodie faggots and proposed an urban business idea. He didn't do muffin, which would sell Sandra Bland's sugar-free shortbreads, a reference to the 28-year-old black woman who in 2015 was taken into custody by a Texas state trooper after a traffic stop and was later found dead in her cell, becoming an early symbol of the Black Lives Matter movement. Neff agreed with other Auto Admit commenters who argued that Michael Brown deserved to be killed by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, complaining that the violent criminals are even more heroic to black people. He claimed that the four liberal congresswomen known as the Squad, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, and Rashida Tlaib, want to make your country a dumping ground for people from third world S-word holes. In another post, Neff warned that once Democrats have the majorities to go full F Whitey, things are going to get really wacky really quickly, and lamented that there's a suicidal impulse to Western peoples that honestly feels almost biological in origin. In July 2020, after a CNN reporter discovered Neff's Auto Admit post, Neff resigned from Fox News. Years later, Neff, who went on to work as a producer on Charlie Kirk's podcast, would maintain that he was the least racist person on Auto Admit, noting that, unlike many of the site's users, I never posted the N-word. Carlson, for his part, said that he was unaware of the posts. We don't endorse those words, he said. They have no connection to this show. But Neff's Auto Admit habit was not a secret to some people he worked with. At the Daily Caller, Neff bragged about his post to at least one colleague. He was really proud of his Auto Admit persona, a former caller staffer remembered. And Neff's connection to Carlson was not a secret on Auto Admit either. In 2017, when Scott Greer, who had been a colleague of Carlson's and Neff's at the Daily Caller, appeared on the Tucker Carlson Tonight to promote his book, No Campus for White Men, Neff dropped a favorite auto-admit catchphrase, the sweet treats of scholarship, into Carlson's script introducing Greer. Neff's fellow auto-admit members didn't miss the Easter egg. "We made it," one wrote. An analysis of the neo-Nazi website, The Daily Stormer, found that between November 2016 and November 2018, Carlson was mentioned in 265 of its articles, most of them featuring clips of his show with titles like "Tucker Fills Liberal Kike with Lead for Demanding Gun Control" and "Tucker Carlson Forces Fat Beaner Whore to Choke to Death on Greasy Tacos." Hannity, by comparison, was the subject of 27 Daily Stormer articles during that period. Laura Ingraham, another of the network's primetime hosts, was the subject of 4. As one blog post on the site celebrated, "Tucker Carlson is basically Daily Stormer, the show. Other than the language used, he is covering all of our talking points." On a Monday morning in April 2023, Carlson was at his winter home in Florida, having just sent his producers the first draft of his monologue for that evening's show, a lengthy attack on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, whom Carlson liked to refer to as Sandy Cortez, invoking her high school nickname, when he got a call from Fox News' chief executive, Suzanne Scott. "We're taking you off the air," Scott told him. He was being fired. Scott offered him the opportunity to include his own statement in a press release that Fox would send out in 15 minutes announcing his departure, a face-saving gesture that would make it seem like the decision was a mutual parting of ways. Carlson refused. If Fox was firing him, he wanted the world to know. When the phone call was over, he sent an email to his staff, known inside Fox as the Tucker Troop, telling them the news. In the days after Carlson's firing, there was much speculation, both inside and outside of Fox, about the reasons behind it. 6 days earlier, the network had settled a lawsuit with Dominion Voting Systems, which alleged that Fox News hosts, including Carlson, had knowingly aired false accusations that the company's voting machines were used to change vote totals in the 2020 presidential election. Some thought that Carlson's dismissal had to do with offensive comments that were revealed during discovery, including a text message in which Carlson reportedly called Irina Briganti, the head of Fox News's media relations department, a C-word. Others wondered whether it could have been because of another lawsuit brought by Abby Grossberg, a former head of booking on Carlson's show, who accused him and the network of creating a hostile work environment. Fox settled the suit for $12 million. Still, others speculated that it had something to do with a potential lawsuit from Ray Epps, a January 6th protester from Arizona who was at the center of a conspiracy theory, amplified by Carlson, that Epps was a government provocateur placed in the crowd to spur an insurrection. In fact, a sympathetic profile of Epps had appeared on 60 Minutes the night before Carlson's firing. Perhaps Murdoch, who at 92 fits squarely in the CBS show's viewer demographic, had seen it and got spooked. Epps's suit was eventually dismissed. Among Fox hosts and executives, stories circulated about a recent dinner Carlson had attended at Murdoch's California Vineyard with Murdoch and his then-fiancée Ann Leslie Smith, during which Smith, who believed that Carlson was a messenger from God, treated him as such. A few days later, Murdoch canceled his engagement to Smith. Now, the theory went, he was canceling Carlson. For his part, Carlson later claimed that his firing was part of Fox's settlement with Dominion. As he told his biographer, Chadwick Moore, he believed that Murdoch had refused Dominion's demand to fork over $1 billion and got the plaintiffs to accept $787 million and his scalp instead. None of the explanations were especially satisfying. In any case, Carlson did not have the luxury of perseverating what befell him. The 2024 presidential election was just 18 months away. Carlson had assumed, with good reason, that Tucker Carlson Tonight would be a major player in that race. But now that he'd lost his Fox megaphone, he'd have to come up with a new vehicle. Complicating matters, Fox was keeping him under contract through 2024 with the express intent of preventing him from hosting a show on another network. That meant he'd still be making the nearly $20 million a year that Fox owed him, but he wouldn't be able to take his act to Newsmax or OANN. Fortunately for Carlson, he had no shortage of other offers that didn't run afoul of Fox's non-compete clause. Just hours after his firing, Elon Musk, who 6 months earlier had bought Twitter and was reshaping the social media platform into a Republican hub, rebranding it as X, called him to talk about a deal. So did Carlson's friend, Omid Malik, who runs 1789 Capital, a venture capital firm that invests in conservative companies. The world is his oyster, one person who was talking to Carlson as the offers came in said. Many billionaires and others with deep pockets would be eager to fund a new venture. Carlson immediately began laying the groundwork for a digital media company, the Tucker Carlson Network, securing Musk help to boost Carlson's content on X and $15 million in seed money from Malik's firm and other investors. He became a frequent visitor to Doha, Dubai, and Riyadh, cities that he once derided as chintzy and prefab, where he developed relationships with other ultra-wealthy individuals. Carlson has said that his network has not received any golf money. Without Fox's built-in audience, not to mention the guardrails of a publicly traded media company, Carlson's new show plunged further into the fever swamps. On one episode, he hosted the notorious conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, who had been successfully sued by the families of Sandy Hook victims for claiming that the shooting was a hoax. Carlson told his viewers that Jones is not a crazy person. On another, he interviewed Larry Sinclair, an ex-con who, during the 2008 presidential campaign, made a long-since discredited claim that he had smoked crack and had sex with Barack Obama when Obama was a little-known state senator. For another episode, Carlson traveled to Romania to conduct a friendly 2.5-hour interview with the misogynistic influencer Andrew Tate, who was under house arrest while awaiting trial for allegations of human trafficking and rape. Carlson had argued that Tate's arrest was obviously a setup and the definition of a human rights violation, while repeatedly hailing him as a role model for young men. Prosecutors in Britain eventually charged Tate with human trafficking, rape, and assault. He is also under investigation in the U.S. Tate has denied all wrongdoing. But Carlson's continued prominence was largely tied to his proximity to Trump. At Fox, he had been one of the network's only stars who maintained a personal and professional distance from the president. Although he frequently parroted Trumpian talking points, Carlson tended to praise Trump policies rather than the man himself. He didn't socialize with the president, and he sometimes even let Trump's phone calls go to voicemail. Tucker was the hot girl that didn't want to F him, one former White House official said. Toward the end of Trump's first term, Carlson actually turned against the president. He criticized Trump on air for his handling of COVID and the Black Lives Matter protests after January 6th. He described Trump in a text message to a Fox colleague as a demonic force, a destroyer. But after leaving Fox, Carlson could no longer afford to keep Trump at bay. He needed Trump, and as it turned out, Trump needed him. Their interests were especially aligned in their mutual disdain for Fox News. Trump had not forgiven Murdoch for trying to disappear him after January 6th. "We want to make Trump a non-person," Murdoch wrote to a former Fox executive, and for using his network to try to boost Ron DeSantis's 2024 presidential prospects. Trump accused Fox of having gone to the dark side. And so when Fox executives began lobbying for Trump to appear at the first GOP presidential primary debate, which the network was hosting, in August 2023, knowing that without Trump, ratings would suffer, Trump strung them along for months. All the while he was talking to Carlson about some sort of counter-programming. Eventually, Carlson and Trump settled on a pre-taped interview that was posted on X at the same time that Fox News carried the debate. Their collaboration continued for the rest of the campaign. Carlson helped persuade Trump to pick Vance as his running mate. At the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, Trump invited Carlson to sit in his private box on the first night and gave him a primetime speaking slot on its final most watched night. A week before the election, Carlson spoke at Trump's Madison Square Garden rally, and when Carlson launched his own 16-city tour that fall, Trump made an appearance as the evening's special guest in Arizona. After the 2024 election, Carlson wielded a shocking amount of power in Trump's Washington. He subscribed to the old Beltway dictum that personnel is policy. In multiple post-election visits to Mar-a-Lago and countless phone calls and texts, he vigorously weighed in on how he believed Trump should fill out his cabinet and staff, pushing in particular for the appointments of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as Secretary of Health and Human Services and Tulsi Gabbard as the Director of National Intelligence. One advisor to the president said Trump wanted Tucker's opinion, and Tucker didn't ever hesitate to offer it. But there have been limits to Carlson's influence. Last summer, as Trump contemplated assisting Israel in its war against Iran, Carlson pleaded with him to keep the U.S. out of the conflict. An attack on Iran, he predicted in a lengthy post on X, would lead to thousands of American deaths, $30 a gallon gasoline, and the collapse of the U.S. economy. It would also, he said, be a profound betrayal of Trump's supporters, who voted for him in part because they viewed him as a peace candidate. In the end, Carlson's protests were for naught. Trump authorized U.S. airstrikes on three Iranian nuclear facilities and dismissed Carlson as kooky. "I don't know what Tucker Carlson is saying," Trump told reporters at one point. "Let him go get a television network and say it so that people listen." Months later, when Carlson interviewed Fuentes, they both decided not to dwell on Trump's apostasy, instead choosing to praise him for creating what Fuentes called this new dialectic that allowed them and others to see the perfidy of Israel more clearly. "Trump planted the seed," Fuentes said. "And the seed was America first," Carlson replied. "So once you accept that, a lot of the way we're doing things becomes impossible to support or justify." "Right, the contradiction becomes apparent," Fuentes said. "It gets moved to the center, and it becomes unignorable if you're consistent." Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Dale with The New Yorker.
Thanks for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lab Radio. Request a free specialized receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call Lab at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Or visit our website where you can tune into Lab Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. Thanks for listening.